This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to Connect with Community Waikato on Free FM 89.0 and as part of our Connect with Community podcast series. This is Roseanne Murray from Community Waikato, and I have with me today Elvisa van der Leeden, who is the Taranaki and Waikato Manager for Forest and Bird. Welcome.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
Hey, no, it's our pleasure to have you with us today. Really exciting topic, and I'm going to look forward to this conversation with you. So maybe firstly, just to start us off, tell us a little bit about Forest and Bird and also around your role.
Sure. So if you haven't heard about Forest and Bird, we are also known as the Royal Forest and Bird Society of New Zealand Incorporated, because we are a non-government organisation, not for profit, national organisation, but we have 45 branches around the country. The organisation is completely dependent on funding, so we have a fundraising team to help us keep going over the years. We're just over 100 years old, so we've grown significantly.
That is such a milestone, isn't it?
Exactly, over that time. And so we've, as an organisation, survived a lot of things over those 100 years. But our kaupapa is, which I should have said right at the start, is that we work really hard to protect our Indigenous biodiversity. And that includes advocacy work, which is our main body of work. We have regional conservation managers like myself based around the country. We all work remotely, and we do a lot of research, policy analysis, a lot of submission writing and letter writing, building relationships and networking to strengthen that kaupapa. We advocate for the conservation and restoration of land, freshwater, oceans, climate, and trying really hard to help build an economy that serves nature. So the way that people can get involved with our organisation is you can do something as simple as follow us on our social medias on Facebook and Instagram. You can make a one-off donation or become a member, which means that you also get our quarterly magazines, which is part of that membership deal. You can stay at our lodges, which you can find on our website, or you can volunteer with our your local Forest and Bird branch. So you can very easily look that up on the internet. We've got all those resources on our website.
Great. And just to test you now, what is the actual website address?
www.forestandbird.org.nz.
All right. Well done.
I hope that's right.
It is. I just saw on the bottom of your signature on your email that
awesome.
That's what you had. So hopefully that's right as well. Hey, no, that's great. And look, you know, I never really realised how many different branches there are around the country, over 45.
Mm.
Yeah. It's huge.
Yeah. So the branches are made up of volunteer committees who are very dedicated conservationists, obviously. They all have different backgrounds. And we also have a subset within the branches. We have the Kiwi Conservation Club for, I think it's under 10s. And then we've got the intermediate age that can either be part of the Kiwi Conservation Club or the youth hubs, which we don't have as many of because that's completely reliant on the youth running it themselves. So it's by youth for youth. So if there are any youth listening who are really into conservation and you don't have a local youth hub, you're always welcome to get in touch with us to start your own. Mm-hmm. So we don't actually currently have a Waikato Forest and Bird Youth Hub. So if anyone's keen to start one in the Waikato, get in touch with us and we'll help you.
Yeah, it sounds like a great little challenge out there, I reckon.
Mm.
Yeah, and there seems to be a lot more younger people, you know, getting back into the environment and have a real, I don't know, sense of, you know, we need to be the kaitiaki, we need to be the guardian of our environment these days.
Absolutely, because, you know, when we plant a tree today, we don't necessarily get to enjoy the shade that it provides later on down the line.
Mm.
And so that's exactly what, you know, us as adults, we do what we can today for the future generations. And I have two toddlers. I have a 1.5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and that's exactly why I do this mahi, because I want to make sure that they have a future that is full of bird life and biodiversity, and they get to enjoy the environment that I am getting to enjoy today. So it's very intergenerational, our work, and when youth get involved in get out into the environment, they really get a sense of purpose. They get a sense of connection with the wider environment and the world. I studied science later on in life, and I didn't grow up in a family that went hiking or did much outdoorsy stuff. But, you know, I'm really grateful that I have made that connection so I can pass that down to my children.
Yeah, look, I think it's a great way for families to just spend some downtime together. Mm. And as you've talked about before, you know, being intergenerational, you know, something that you can do, grandparents with their grandchildren or their own children. Mm. Really interesting. So talking about your kaupapa, what are some key things that you're focusing on at the moment?
We're always focusing on trying to protect what is left, but also supplementing that with trying to restore as much as we can. So, for instance, we write a lot of submissions on, developments that come up, housing developments, other things that mean that it might impact on biodiversity, such as like solar farms and wind farms. And then we have to think about peka peka bats, the impacts on birds and bats, and there's a lot of good stuff happening with the RMA. We, you know, can use that as a way to ensure that these developments do incorporate restoration projects as well, that kind of, I guess, in some ways offset. But we want to protect what already exists, which is the first and foremost, focus of our work. And so at the moment, there's a lot going on in our space where we're working really hard to protect conservation land and like Archie's frogs and the Wharekiroponga part of the Coromandel Park from underground mining, because we just don't know what impacts those sort of mining activities have on species like Archie's frogs, and also dewatering. They need to take water to do their operations of their business, and so that affects wetlands and streams and rivers. And so a lot of our work is to make sure that the conditions, if the projects are approved, that the conditions reduce the impact on the natural environment as much as possible. And part of that work, just knocked something over.
That's all right.
Part of the work includes, simplifying some of the solutions that could actually help reduce the impact, but also have other benefits. And one of those concepts is nature-based solutions. So, for instance, if someone wants to build a house or build a development with lots of housing, making sure that they incorporate infrastructure that is actually, you don't always have to build a pipe somewhere. For instance, you can restore a wetland that soaks up extra water. Mm. You can plant trees that slow down the travel of water that reaches the ground. So it's an interweaving of systems that helps reduce flooding, but also improves biodiversity, increases biodiversity, and creates habitat for other species to come in, and which also improves community well-being, connection with nature, and reduces or mitigates climate change. It absorbs carbon. So there's a multitude of benefits to a simple solution that is nature-based. So that's what nature-based solutions is mainly about, and it's something that councils and developers, any kind of business, I guess, can consider in the planning for their development.
Yeah, and I think it's just sort of having that education, isn't it, and exposure to what could be, you know, that they could be doing out there. And plus also too, probably having a fuller understanding of, you know, that the potential impact that they are having on, sort of all of our sort of wildlife and everything else. We were talking off air about our connection to Taranaki. And oh, yes. I just sort of thought of, obviously, State Highway 3, those that travel down to Taranaki have to go up over Mount Messenger and the massive big work that's happening there to put in the bypass. And, you know, I read up all the time how Waka Kotahi and the contractors are working with local iwi around the protection of a lot of the fauna and also to our sort of native species and stuff.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in these sort of situations, you know, like we were not in support of it, but at the end of the day, we ended up working alongside DOC to ensure the conditions were as best as possible. And, yeah, unfortunately, there are areas where we have to compromise, especially when it comes to resourcing. There's only so much fight that you can put into something. We were talking about earlier about with all the fast track projects going on, we are in a very, very busy period with very limited resources legal wise to put into those cases. So, yeah, with Mount Messenger, it can be quite divisive as well.
I think the key thing there is at least it's not like probably back in the old days when it would have just been, let's build it and let's make it happen.
Definitely,
you know, there's been a lot more consultation and, you know, I know iwi sort of constantly and, you know, sort of there as observers, I suppose.
Yes,
As well. And I know the connection they have with DOC as well. So any, you know, sort of what are some of the projects? I know we talked a little bit about planting of native bushes and stuff like that. So is there anything in particular that, you know, you can sort of share with us in that space at the moment?
Yeah, well, I always come back to the cabbage tree. I can't remember the Māori name for it at this stage, but it is a really, you'll see a lot of cabbage trees in wetland environments because they have these huge tap roots. And what they do is those huge tap roots are like sponges and they just soak up a lot of that moisture and that wetness and help with, I guess, equalising, you know, the environment, balancing out the environment, equalising. Yeah, so they help with balancing out that wetland environment. And so when we have, and we have like rushes, different types of rushes and different types of other shrubby sort of mangroves, for instance, are really key species in estuarine environments because they hold that sediment together. And so in different environments, wetlands, estuaries, wet environments, we have very specific species that thrive in those environments because they help balance out that the water system, I guess. Another aspect to consider is also making room for rivers. So historically, we used to have these moving, cascading rivers that moved through the land, eroded, and then built up. We don't have that anymore because we've built into the rivers and we've tried to control the rivers and keep them in a straight line. And now nature's trying to take back what it, you know, needs to move. And so we're starting to, as a society, with all the flooding going on around the world and locally now, we're starting to realise that actually we do need to give more space back to nature and we do need to give back to nature to actually protect our own livelihoods as well. And by doing so, we're also, you know, absorbing carbon, like all those things that I mentioned earlier. But the right tree in the right place is also something to be aware of. Those cabbage trees in those wet places are really keen, really good species to have. And people who are doing the planting, it's just really good to do your research and to look up what not only what the best kind of plant or tree is best placed in those environments, but also what was there historically. We talk about seed sourcing, making sure that we have locally produced seeds that produce vegetation that existed in those environments originally, historically, and that helps bring back the species and birds and bugs and lizards that have lived there historically as well. So yeah, the right tree in the right place. It's quite a fun exercise for me personally, actually, because there's a lot of pūrākau, which is like storytelling from Te Ao Māori, of why those trees were in those places and what the Māori world view of that species was, all the rongoa, the you know, historical medicine that it was used for. Not that that's part of Forest and Birds' work, but it's just really interesting that that comes in
when
you research about it. There's a really good book that I like called The Meaning of Trees, and it has a lot of different aspects to one, or lots of different little stories to one species, and then onto the next species, and it tells you about the history and the types of birds that it services and stuff like that. Services is a weird word to use, but yeah, that it feeds or provides habitat for. Yeah.
And I think you've made a really good point around, you know, what was there in the first place, because obviously there's been a lot of sort of, you know, cleansing of all the sort of, you know, trees and other sort of, you know, native plants, you know, when we've sort of looked at wanting to produce more, have more paddocks for farming, or now even these days, you know, I drive past, being a former farmer myself, drive past this beautiful pasture and it's now been developed into some sort of, you know, housing development. And I sort of go, oh, it's, you know, what a waste of beautiful land, but can understand, you know, what we need to be doing these days. Yeah, it is interesting, actually. You see a lot of farmers now, and it's great to see, and I was just saying again off air, I just happened to say watch Country Calendar on Sunday night, like I'm sure a lot of other people did, and these orchard people that own an orchard over Katikati Way, they were planting restoration, had a lot of restoration work going on with a lot of native plants around sort of little waterways and stuff like that. So what's the significance of that?
So that's called riparian planting, which is basically planting along the edges of streams and rivers, because riparian planting is basically adding a filter system to another nature-based solution to the runoff or the extra nutrients that things like kaupu ends up in our waterways, and that's how our waterways have become so degraded and full of phosphorus and nitrates, which is not good for us to swim in. And so part of a nature-based solution is planting along those waterways, and it creates a bit of a filtration system, and it creates corridors for our native biodiversity to travel through to the next plot of, say, conservation land. A really good example of this is what you were talking about earlier, being from Taranaki. If you fly over Mount Taranaki, you can see it's a perfect circle within the national park there. And when you fly over it, you can see all the riparian planting that's starting to mature off the maunga.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got Lake Rotokari, which is the east Taranaki.
Yes, it is.
Near Stratford. And so if you can imagine all the little waterways that are planted out and all those corridors going from Mount Taranaki to Rotokari, and then say, for instance, in the far future, maybe not far future, hopefully near future, you've got Maunga Tautari and you've got all the other plots of sanctuaries around the country. If they were all connected through planted out waterways, we'd have this beautiful connectivity where biodiversity can travel through, and it would just be really great to have that vision, you know, come to life. And farmers are really key people in bringing that vision to life, because we've lost so much. Over 90% of our forests have been removed, destroyed for farming and other developments. So, you know, to bring back a little bit of that through riparian planting is just one key element to restoring what we once had in terms of bird life and biodiversity. Yeah, there's also another project from Porongia to Maunga Tautari that has a sort of similar concept of connecting those two conservation sort of areas. I live in Tokoroa in the South Waikato, and I'm often seeing people from Arapuni, which is south of Maunga Tautari. They see a lot of kaka coming into their yards, and they've got the river there as well, which is a food source for them. So I'm starting to see more of these positive stories of people seeing more tui and kereru and kaka in their backyards because of things like riparian planting, creating connectivity. And I really encourage people to plant natives in your backyard, even if you have fruit trees, actually. you might see some kittadoo come and eat your fruit because they've I was just saying earlier on a friend's post that kittadoo are little fruit piggies, but they're really good. Birds are also really good for fertilizing soils. So they spread seeds. They are really good for soil. They're guano. So they do a lot of good for us, for our well-being and for the health of our environment.
Oh, and look, I think it's just they're very stimulating as well. Like my mum's in a little rest home out at Tamahere, and very fortunate she's got a lovely couple of trees out from her ranch slider, and she just loves it how the tui come in. But just all of the different types of birds, like, you know, when I'm talking to her, it's sort of like, you know, I had a blackbird and it was in the bird bath, and, you know, and the little sparrows and wax eyes and robins and you name it, you know. It just, you know, it just keeps her stimulated. She's just absorbed by it, you know, seeing these beautiful little creatures.
Yeah. We've got a few free tree ferns. Unfortunately, they keep getting taken over by the ivy. Tokoroa is very rampant with ivy. So we're trying really hard to keep that under control. But the piwakawaka love our little backyard. We don't have a lot in it. I'm slowly growing, you know, the stuff in it. But, yeah, they come to visit us and the kids love it. Piwakawaka, piwakawaka.
Oh, they fascinate me. You know, their lovely little tails. Yeah, for those that are not sure what we're talking about, the fantail.
Yes. Oh, sorry,
Yeah, no, that's all good. Yeah. Hey, look, time is going fast. We've still got a few more minutes to go. What else is happening in your space?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we are just over 100 years old. We just turned 100 either last year or the year before. Time goes so fast for me. Yeah. I'm like, oh, what year is it? So, and this year is our 20-year anniversary of Bird of the Year. Ah. So Bird of the Year is the first week of September. You can go online and vote for, I think it's up to 5 birds that you would like to see win Bird of the Year. You may have remembered last year that the campaign actually reached America with John Oliver's campaign for Pūtiketike, which won thanks to him. And so this year we've got the book Bird of the Year, the Bird of the Year book, which our friend Alan Riker's authored. It's telling the story of Bird of the Year and all the winners over the years and the stories that go with that. And we've also got beautiful illustrations in that book from multiple artists such as Melissa Boardman, who you can follow on Instagram as well. So it is a really beautiful book, very brightly coloured. It's got some really funny stories in there. So you can purchase that book at your nearest bookstore. You can purchase it online, and you can go online and vote once that campaign opens up.
All right, and that's in the first week of September, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So how does it work? Is there like 5 different birds nominated? Is there 5 different types of birds nominated, and you choose one of those 5?
Well, you've got 5 votes.
Oh, you've got 5 votes.
Yeah.
Okay, you can choose then any type of bird. Is that
any
how it
type
works?
Of bird, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it could be the tui.
Could be. Yep.
The piwakawaka.
Aye, and then we've got... also, for each bird on the website that you vote on, it'll indicate what vulnerability level or what categorization of threatened, is it threatened, you know, endangered, whatever. So you can learn more about those birds as well as you scroll through.
All right. Oh, that's cool. So obviously that's on your website, which, again, for our listeners is www.forestandbird.org.nz. So it sounds like some great information on your website.
Yeah.
Coming up, and obviously it'll be social media platforms as well.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it's been pumped out.
Yep.
So let's challenge, I think. Let's not let the Americans sort of outvote us this time.
No. And try to vote for birds that haven't won yet, and which you can actually look up and is in Bird of the Year book as well. So I always vote for a different penguin each year to make sure that the penguins are always included.
Yeah.
I actually saw a really funny one because one year the Pika Pika won because we included the bat as Bird of the Year. It's not a bird, but it's an avian animal. And it won that year, and then it was taken off the following year. So we don't have it in there anymore. That'll be in the book. And so I saw someone subsequently say, a bat for Bird of the Year. Well, maybe we should have penguin for Fish of the Year.
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah, indeed. So just quickly, what's your favourite bird?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, we'll say kōrora because I was an environmental educator and one of my projects was saving the little blue penguin around Taranaki. Well, not just saving it, but also raising awareness that we have little blue penguin in the North Island.
I know, and hailing from Taranaki, I did not know we had those penguins on our foreshore, so that's been a real learning opportunity for me. And they're gorgeous little creatures, aren't they?
They're very cute, until they make a noise and they just sound really weird.
So native tree or plant? What would be one of your favourites?
I've just learned, I've just been gifted some seeds for kaka beak. So I think that's my favourite at the moment. I'm going to try and propagate kaka beak.
Okay. All right. And what's in your backyard then right now?
Oh, I've planted a dwarf tōtara, a manuka, kānuka. I had kawakawa, but they died in the frost. So we'll have to try that one again in a more sheltered spot. Oh, and fern trees and some harakeke. So two different species of harakeke or flax.
Yep.
That I don't know the names of, those subspecies, but they're there.
All right. Hey, that's great. Any last-minute messages before we finish up?
Just that we would love for you to follow us on our social media, Forest and Bird. And if you have the capacity, we'd love to have you volunteer with us. So you can look up on our website your nearest Forest and Bird branch. Our committee members would really love to see more people joining our membership and getting involved.
And also too, they're looking for maybe youth to come along and run a youth hub here in the Waikato as well.
That's the dream. Dream.
All right. And I'm sure Alfisa will be keen to just help you out and point you in the right direction if you are interested in that. And then that, as you've said, the whole kaupapa, it's very intergenerational, you know, whether young people, you know, parents or grandparents, great way to all get involved and learn more about our forest and bird out there. And
marine life.
And our marine life with our penguins, which are wherever they're going to be and amongst the mix. Yeah, I know, that's cool. Look, thank you very much, Alfisa, for coming in and talking to us all about Forest and Bird and your role. And you can tell that you're very, very passionate about what you do. And look, it's an amazing, amazing mahi. It's great that we've got people like yourself that are looking to, you know, do their part to protect our biodiversity out there. So thank you very much for coming into the studio and coming all the way up from Tokoro to meet with me and have a good chat today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. Ka kite.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.